Is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. I'm always so excited to welcome back multi-talented producer, writer, actor, author, Stephen L. Sears. I mean, he's fun. He's a great storyteller. He always has incredible things to talk about, and he's enchanting, and I think you'll be enchanted by him. Here's Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Sherry. How are you doing on this fine post-rainy day?
Okay. How about you?
Still cleaning up from the mess here. I don't know when this is going to broadcast, but most people... at least we're aware that we had this confluence of storms coming through Southern California. So a lot of people, some people lost their homes, a lot of mudslides. The what we laughingly refer to as the LA River, which is basically just some concrete canyons that have been built for irrigation runoff. Those filled up and flooded. So it was pretty intense. The rain lasted for quite a while. I know for those of you who are living like on the southeast are like, huh, are you kidding? Rain? Who cares? But you're prepared for it. We're not.
Yeah.
So here at the household, we did pretty well. The hill stayed up. Didn't have much in the way of flooding. Mostly we just stayed home and worked and made it through. Got another storm coming in a little later on, but it won't be as bad. So there you go. That's your weather report. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the rest of the day. Bye-bye.
And thank you for tuning in to Sherry's News Broadcast. Anyway.
Oh, there we go. That was quick.
Well, I had a leak in my roof, and it leaked right onto my bed. That was on the first storm. They came
so
and they...
So you're telling me that for the first time in your life, your bed wet you?
Yeah. It was in the middle of the night. And all of a sudden I heard drip, drip, drip. I'm like, what the hell? Because I have a clock that I can hear as a real loud tick, but it was a totally different noise, and it was closer. And I look at the end of my bed, and it was going drip, drip, right on the end of the... Yeah, like that. Just like that.
One of the few sound effects I can actually do.
Yeah, right at the end of my bed. So,
well, that's a bummer.
Yeah, so I ran and I got a towel.
We had a couple of leaks out in our sunroom. Yeah, we put a couple of buckets out there, and one of them got a little gnarly, but our sunroom has been like that for years, so it gets a few leaks when we have big storms come in, so which means it's not a sunroom. It's basically an aquarium.
Yeah, I know. Well, I live in an apartment, so they fixed it.
Oh.
They fixed the roof. As soon as it stopped raining, of course. But apparently it was the entire building. There was, like, leaks all over the place. And
not surprising, considering the intensity of this storm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was the first one. It wasn't even the second one, which was much worse. So I was really glad they fixed it, because I was like... The whole roof would have fallen in probably with that.
Well, then you would have made the news.
No, I wouldn't want that. I don't want to make the news.
No, not in that particular way.
No, I don't want to make the news at all.
Some of the video that's been online about the, especially, like I said, the L.A. rivers, which, for those of you who have not been here, literally in L.A., you'll just see these concrete canals that were built, and it's built basically just for emergency runoff. But when we do have a big storm, that thing will fill up into a raging river. We have a very very, very active rapid water rescue division of our emergency services, and they do a lot of work.
Yeah, because people are silly and they walk across the where the river is, even though they warn you not to do that.
Well, everybody is, you know, it's like that little immortality gene that says, hey, watch this, hold my beer, I want to do something stupid and I'll live through it. And, you know, you get into a lot of trouble that way. But, yeah, we have people who think they're going to actually kayak down it. And anybody who lives in, like, Texas and the Midwestern, Western states where you get flash floods, you certainly know, hey, there's running water across the road. Maybe I shouldn't go through it. But other people will just say, I'm just going to go right through it. And then they get swept away because it's not something to screw with.
No. No. And I've seen it. I mean, it's really scary when you're driving by and you can see the, what I still call the LA River, going flushing. Uh-huh. And you can see it actually, water coming up on the bridge. And you're just like, it really is scary. It's really, it's like a rapid.
Now, we had a few of those here last night when I was it last night? Night before last. Jessica and I, my wife, we were coming back from a dinner with some friends, and we had another band of rain that had come through, pretty severe. And so we're driving through it. And the other thing you have to worry about out here, with LA being so dry during the year, oil builds up in the pavement, in the asphalt of the actual freeway. So the first couple of days of rain, all that oil comes up, becomes very slippery. But then later on, if the rain lasts and you're in a mountainous area, you have to worry about mud that just basically seeps onto the road, makes it slippery. So you could be driving down the road in a, you know, all-wheel drive vehicle, in our case it was our Jeep, and a nice gust of wind hits you, and you wonder, oh my gosh, I'm sliding. Why would I be sliding with that? And it's just because the road is a little slippery.
Yeah.
It's not something to mess with.
It's sort of like ice, but it's not ice.
Okay, that's a good way. It's kind of like peanut butter, but not. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know what I mean. I mean, you get
the
same reaction.
It gives you that effect of it.
Yeah.
But the advantage, if you live in an area where you have a lot of ice, you're actually pretty familiar with how to drive on ice. So that gets back to what I said earlier. LA is not built for this.
No.
So when it does happen, that's why, you know, all the running gags about how people in LA don't know how to drive in rain. Well, that's true, because they haven't had to.
That's true. Not bad rain. Though we do get storms. You know, there was a
well,
old
here,
song.
I like to think that no rain is bad rain. It's just really how it's raised.
Okay. my brother was driving home from, from work, and he said it never rains in California. I said, oh, I remember that old song, and he didn't remember it at all. He goes, he just thought it was ironic.
Oh yeah, well, that of course was the actual point of that song, was, you know, idealism and reality colliding. So yeah. It pours.
Yes, it pours in California. Do not believe that
That's
song.
Right.
We do have weather, okay?
Yep. When it does rain, it can pour.
Yes.
I think a long time ago, back when I first moved out to Los Angeles, my best friend at the time, and the guy who I broke into the industry with, Bert Pearl, he and I, just for the heck of it, this was before we weren't writers at the time, we were just playing around, and we started actually writing, like I said, mostly for the fun of it, a little book called The LA Circus, and somewhere I still have these pages, at least what we wrote, where we were just giving our reactions to Los Angeles as if it was going to be a tour guide. And in it we discussed everything from the type of people that were here, the driving, the diversity, but on the weather, we had a very short paragraph, and back then, we said that the rainy season in Los Angeles extends from middle November until the beginning of January, and it consists of one large drop. And for a long time, that was true, and then we went through a drought, and then this one was kind of like, oh yeah, now I remember.
That's funny. No, we do have really bad rainy times. And we've actually had snow in Southern California. People don't believe me, but we have.
Well, the great thing about Southern California, one of the great things, and we can also list, you know, all of the bad things, but let's not go there. One of the great things I've always liked about Southern California is the diversity in the geography. And I have actually done this, where you can actually go water skiing in the morning, then go snow skiing at night on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have done that.
Yeah, that's easy. Go water skiing in Santa Monica and then drive up to Mammoth and go skiing.
Yeah, or well, not even that far. You just, like, what I did is, you know, Lake Piru is where I used to water ski, and that's up near, just past Magic Mountain. So it's just a little farther north of Los Angeles. So I had a boat back then, and we'd take it up there, go water skiing in the morning, then we would go up to either Big Bear or Mountain High. Yeah, I'm giving an advertisement out for Mountain High, which is one of the local ski resorts, and we'd go snow skiing. And at least a couple of times I did that. But you can do that down here. We have such a diverse amount of topography. That's why, certainly in the film and television business, back when most of it was being shot here in Southern California, it looked like, oh, there's a, you know, they're in the jungles of the Amazon. No, you're not. You're at the Pasadena Arboretum. Or you are suddenly in the deserts of Tunisia. Well, not actually, you're up in Red Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all of that topography. And it really is. It really is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, we do have a lot of really interesting, I mean, they shot a lot of stuff at Warner Brothers back lot and Paramount Ranch and all that stuff. But it wasn't scenery. It was, they had the mountain that the thing of the helicopters went over for MASH. I mean, that was really there.
Yeah, it was in Malibu Canyon.
Yeah,
Malibu Canyon State Park. And you can still, for those of you out there who need a tour guide, you can still visit the set, the exterior set where MASH was shot in Malibu Canyon. They had several years ago, they rededicated it because they wanted to try to recreate parts of it. It was a big deal. They had a lot of the stars from there. I went there. I took a whole lot of photos. And the way they had set it up, as soon as you got there, you kind of realized, oh, yeah, that's the helicopter pad right there. And if
mm-hmm.
you looked off in the mountains, you saw the opening credits where they came through the mountain pass with the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still there. Now,
okay.
I will say, to get to it is a bit of a hike, because you do have to hike. And man, I went there with a friend of mine, and, you know, this was a while back, so we were, you know, relatively young compared to now. And, you know, for most people, you should know that MASH was set in the Korean War, so
yes,
back in the 1950s. So we're hiking, and part of it is a nice paved path, and then you get into kind of like into the woods, and then you get into small narrow ravines, and you are literally climbing over rocks. Now, as we were going up there, there was this gentleman who was probably in his late 70s, early 80s, and we talked to him, and he was going to the MASH site to see the dedication because he was actually in the Korean War, and MASH was his favorite series.
Aww.
And so now he was just had a little cane, and he was kind of moving along, and, you know, as we walked away from him, we agreed that as soon as we got there, we were going to tell them, you need to send somebody back and bring him around some other way. And so when we got there, we were trying to find the right person to report that to, and I'll be darned, this guy showed up. He had walked that entire distance, and then we kind of looked at each other and went, yeah, he's a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something unusual for him.
Yeah, and I think that's super. And I love that he loves MASH. It shows what a great show it was.
Well, I've told you the story before, which I've already kind of given the ending to it. Within the first month of me moving out to L.A., you know Chip Chalmers, who was one of the biggest directors in the 90s, and Chip had gone to the school I went to, which was Florida State University. And so Chip had gone back to visit. He was a production coordinator at Fox Studios. And he told everybody, hey, if you come out to Los Angeles, give me a call. And I was thinking to myself, well, you just made a big mistake, mister. So I wrote down his phone number. And as soon as I got out here, I called him, and, you know, so we could have lunch, and I could just pick his brain. And he said, oh, yeah, we set a date. And the day we were supposed to have lunch, I called him to confirm, and he said, we're really busy. Come down to the studio, and we'll have lunch at the commissary. And I was like, oh, my God, this is a studio. I've never been on a studio lot. So I went down there, and just walking to his place, trying to find his bungalow, because I got to walk on all those old streets that they had manufactured for the movies and everything. Mm-hmm. So I get to his bungalow, and he apologizes again. He says, we're really busy. We'll have to go and eat on the stage. And I'm like, oh, my God, a studio stage. I've never been on a studio stage. So we walk down to this stage, and he gets a phone call, and he turns to me. He goes, I got to bail. I hate to do this to you. And he turns to one of the actors, and he says, would you mind having lunch with my friend? And the guy says, sure. And so this was the set of MASH. And that was David Odkin Stiers that he handed me off to.
Cool.
So I sat there. Within a month of being out in L.A., I was on the set of MASH having lunch with David Odkin Stiers, Loretta Swit, Alan Alda was walking around, Harry Morgan was walking around. And, of course, I'm sitting there going, is this how it happens? Oh, my God, this was so awesome. So that was my first experience on an actual set, and it was a set of MASH.
That is really cool. My first experience on a set was I was working at Universal Studios, and I was on the tour. I worked on the tour, and I was down at the lot. This will tell you how long ago this was. I was 16. I worked in the Bionic Center. On part of the tour where they went in and they saw the different special effects for the Bionic Man, $6 million man and Bionic Woman.
Yes, all the things we tried to pretend that we did, which we didn't actually do, but yes, go ahead.
Yes, exactly. So you were allowed to, as a studio employee, to eat in the commissary. And I was waiting online at the commissary, and Robert Wagner and Eddie Adler were in front of me, and he saw our uniforms. It was me and another girl, and Robert Wagner says, "Oh, go ahead. We have a lot longer than you do. Go ahead of us." And I went, "Thank you, sir." I was like, "Wow."
Yeah. Yeah, believe it. Actors are human beings.
Yeah. No. Well, now I know that. 16-year-old.
Mel Brooks said to the producers, "Have you ever eaten with one?"
Well, I was 16. It was Robert Wagner from It Takes a Thief who was saying that to me because they were just starting to do Switch, and Eddie Albert from Green Acres. I mean, that's what I was thinking. I didn't say it, but that's what I was thinking. I just said, thank you.
RJ was, Robert Wagner was also one of the people I had met on the set of Heart to Heart.
Another favorite show.
I had nothing to do with that show. A friend of mine was a friend of his. And so this was much later after the MASH thing, of course. And he took me down there and introduced me to Robert Wagner. And that was also great. I mean, I liked him quite a bit.
He was really nice. They were both really nice. But one of the cool things was at Universal, they had the regular area, the commissary, and then there was the dining room. And if you made a reservation, even as one of the people on the tour, you could eat in the dining room. And that's where the actors ate. They didn't eat in the commissary part. So after I saw them, we learned to make reservations so we could see the movie stars and TV stars. But I mean, the first set I was on was, this was long before this. It was Welcome Back, Kotter. My aunt was related to Gabe Kaplan, and she invited all my cousins to go see one of the shows. And then we got to meet the actors after, because she knew she was Gabe Kaplan was her cousin. And my big moment was I got to meet John Travolta, and I told him that I saw him in, I can't even remember which show it was, but I had just seen him in a TV movie. And he gave me a kiss. And I was like, you know Marcia in the Brady Bunch when Davy Jones kissed her on the cheek? Oh, no, Desi Arnaz kissed her on the cheek? That's how
was
I felt.
Was it Desi Arnaz? Or was it, because Davy Jones was on there. I didn't know Desi Arnaz was
on it. Yeah, Desi Arnaz was on it too. It was Desi Arnaz who did it, kissed her.
Okay.
Desi Arnaz was on because her diary was stolen, and she talked about how much she loved Desi Arnaz. And Alice, I can't believe I remember this. And Alice was good friends with Lucille Ball's housekeeper. And because she had written to Desi Arnaz asking him to come to her prom, she got in real trouble because she couldn't get him, even though she was begging for him to come. And next thing she knew, Desi came to her house. It's really silly. But I'm just saying, there's a scene in the show where he kisses her on the cheek, and she's like, I'll never wash my cheek again, and she walks upstairs. And I felt the same way. It was years later when John Travolta kissed me. I mean, I was about the same age. It was about, like I said, I was about 16. No, I was younger. My aunt took me. I was about 13. So I was like...
So how dirty is that cheek now?
No, I washed it. I got over it.
Oh, I see.
I grew up.
Don't tell John. He'll be terrifically disappointed.
I don't think John would even remember it.
No, he would say, no, weren't you the girl with the really dirty cheeks? Yeah, I think that's what he would do.
Yeah, but I was one of those silly preteens.
Well, a lot of people, as obviously in this business, when you meet your celebrity heroes, there's an old adage that says, you know, don't meet your heroes. I kind of look at it the reverse. There are your heroes, and there are the people who portray your heroes. And some of them are good, some of them are bad. They're all human. I don't want to say that I'm a judgmental person, but one thing I do pay attention to with friends of mine who are celebrities is how they treat their fans, and more importantly, how they regard their fans when the fans are not there. And I certainly have been very fortunate that a lot of the people who have become my long-term friends, probably for that reason, they are absolutely wonderful in the way they respect the fans and the way they treat them. Other people I know of are, you know, treat them really well when they're selling stuff to them, and then, you know, completely disregard them later on, or talk bad about them. And I can honestly say those people are not generally my friends. So it is kind of an important distinction. And of course, for fans, you have to keep in mind what the celebrities are going through, because they get a lot of people who come up to them, and a lot of people assume that because they've seen them in their favorite movies or TV series that they are actually close friends, and they're not really close friends. But there's a balance. And in the most cases, the fans know that balance. The good people in the industry, they understand that balance as well.
I think that's really... See, the thing is, because I grew up in L.A., it was a little weird for me, because, like, I grew up across the way from people that were TV stars and down the street, a stuntman, and so it was... I didn't live in a fancy area, but it was a nice area. You know what I mean? And so I wasn't like crazy drooling fan because I grew up around it. But I have to say, when I met somebody I really liked, I became extremely shy.
and I could hardly speak sometimes. Like Alan Alda, when I met him, he was somebody I loved since I was 9 years old, and I saw him in the first commercial for MASH wearing his white coat telling the audience about MASH, and we had just moved to Ohio, and he was, so I've loved him my whole life practically. So meeting him as an adult for the first time at a dinner for a charity that I work for, it was like meeting God almost. I mean, and I was an adult. To me, it was, because that's how much I had built him up. Thank God he's a really nice man, because but I acted very respectfully and normal, as normally as I could. But I was quiet. I kept moving closer because I don't think he could hear me.
I'm generally, I'm not a starstruck person. And I've even looked back on my life and said, why is that true? And, you know, a lot of it has to do with just, you know, I hate to say it, but the way I was raised. But, you know, I respect people for who they are. Like, you know, you automatically have respect from me. You can lose it. You can definitely lose it. But, you know, philosophy out of our household, from my dad especially, was you can be, you know, cleaning toilets at a grocery store, or you could be the leader of the nation. As long as you do an honest day's work, you're equals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always kind of looked at it that way. But there have been moments, there have been definite moments where I have just literally, the little child in my back of my head says, you do know who you were just talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone, oh my gosh, that's true. Didn't even think about that. And I remember on a, there used to be a TV show back in the 60s called The Time Tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a science fiction show, for those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about. And it dealt around this government project, which had built a gigantic tunnel-like device in the desert, which was a time tunnel. They hoped to be able to go back in time with this. And the funding was about to be shut down on it. And there were two scientists who had been working on this. And one of them was a young, impetuous guy named Tony. And that was played by Jimmy Darren.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is they're about to shut it down, but he's determined to prove it can work. So in the middle of the night, he goes into the time tunnel and gets lost in time. And then there was a the other scientist decided, well, I've got to go back and try to rescue him. So he gets the other scientist to run the equipment, and he goes back, and Robert Colbert played the other one. And the first episode was they land on the Titanic. Now, what the series was about is at the end of every episode, they would then, the group back in the current time would try to yank them out of that time to bring them back home, but all they could do was yank them into another time. So each episode was in a different time period. They had a really nice one about Pearl Harbor, where the character of Tony realized his father had been killed at Pearl Harbor, and he had a chance to see his father. So there were some really nice episodes.
I liked that.
But I love this series. Yeah. And as a child, anytime myself and my friends played Time Tunnel, I was always playing Tony. I was the kid who took on the character of Tony. So anyway, calendar pages fly off, picture that in your head, and now I'm working as a writer, and I'm working with Stephen Cannell Productions, and the first single credit that I had, Bert and I worked together as a team for a long time, but the first single credit I had was on an A-Team episode, and that A-Team episode was called Family Reunion, and that one was directed by Jimmy Darren.
Oh.
Jimmy had decided he wanted to be a director, so he had been signed up for it, and of course I was talking to him about some of the stuff. Of course, we had to discuss the script. I was just a staff writer, but Steve Cannell's company was very much, you are interactive. You're not just somebody who stays in your office. And so I was engaged to my first wife at the time, and I was at her place, and it was the night before we started filming. So I was on the phone with Jimmy talking about some changes in the script. And when I was done with the phone call, I said goodbye to him. I said, I'll see you tomorrow, and hung up. And my fiance, she said, who was that? And I turned to her, I said, oh, that was, and then I paused and I went, That was Tony from Time Tunnel. It hadn't even hit me up until that point. He was just Jimmy up until that point. And then I realized, oh my God, this was the guy that was Tony. So sometimes that does happen. And it is a very bizarre out-of-body experience.
Yeah. I actually worked with him. I was one of the extras on T.J. Hooker when I was in my 20s.
Uh-huh.
And he was really, is a very, very nice man. He's very much alive.
Yeah. Yes, he is. I think he actually has a podcast these days.
Does he? Oh, I would
yeah,
love
I think
to
so.
Hear that.
Not sure, but I he did at one point.
He's so nice and down to earth. Just a doll. but yeah, I liked him a lot. But
yeah.
But it's weird. See, I was in a different. You're a writer, so you were at the equal level. I was an extra. I was kind of not at an equal level. You can always tell what kind of a person they were when you met them, and there were some people that were not so nice that were...
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't big stars. They were just, you know, co-stars or something like that. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, people get full of themselves. This
yeah.
business can do that.
Yeah. I mean,
I tell a lot of people getting into the business that this is a yes business. When you become successful, you're going to get a lot of yeses, and people are going to just give you accolades. And I've said this, the vast majority of you are going to be jerks at one point in your life, at least once. And how quickly you catch it and change it will determine whether you work again.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I've been only disappointed, really, really disappointed, because they were people I really admired twice, and I won't say who they were. I was treated really badly. Neither of those were professional. I was just a fan at a fan event, and they really hurt my feelings and. My mother never forgave them.
Yeah. Yeah, it does happen. And we just lost somebody recently who, by the way, was a good friend of mine and was just on the gauge of how he treated his fans was just awesome. And that was Carl Weathers.
Oh. My brother and I were talking about how wonderful. I've never met him, but he was a wonderful person. The charity work he did and how wonderful he was and yeah.
No, Carl was just a gem. Carl, I'm still a little affected by it because he and I were friends. I'm not going to say we were best friends or we hung out every day, but the last email I had with him was just a few weeks ago, where we were talking about syncing up our calendar so we could have lunch this coming month. To discuss some things that, you know, he and I talked about working on projects again together. And I first met him when I was producing Sheena for Sony, Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. And we were, you know, of course, hiring directors. And Sony had suggested Carl to me. And my first reaction, quite honestly, was like, wow, this action star wants to be a director. All right, you know. But then they sent me some of his reels where he'd been doing some stuff on a show called Strong Medicine, which was not an action show. That was what we call a talking head show. So it was all about character. And I looked at the reel, and I'm like, okay, this looks really good. So I asked if he would come into the office and discuss. Now, I sent him some material, but I deliberately sent him one specific script. And this was a script I had written. I just posted about this on my Facebook page. This was a script I had written, which the studio was a little uncomfortable with. And it was a script, I had interpreted myself and Doug Schwartz. Doug and I had co-created this version of Sheena. We interpreted Sheena in modern-day Africa, so a conflict of nationalism, tribalism, colonialism, what it's done to Africa today. We put her in as kind of a figure in the middle of all of this, tried to ignore a lot of the stuff from the 1930s version of Sheena, which of course, you know, was completely outdated in a lot of its social appreciation. So we tried to make it more about modern Africa and the conflicts. And so I had written a script that dealt with modern-day human trafficking. And there obviously were going to be racial overtones in this. So I wrote this script up, and then I thought, you know what? I'm going to send this one to Carl. I want him to read this because he will be able to give me his reaction to it. As an African-American, I wanted to know what his reaction was to it because I want to know where I'm slipping up. So I sent it to him. Now, when he came into the office, first thing, he was just affable. Well, first thing you notice, he walks in and he's a presence. He was big. Mm-hmm. I mean, big in the way he just strode in, confident. But he was friendly. He was affable. We chatted a bit. And then we got into the script. And I could not believe how Carl had analyzed the script. He had found levels. He explored levels. He talked about character. He talked about nuance. It was amazing. And I really, really, I just like, this was one of those conversations where I just don't want it to end. And so finally, I just said, look, you're hired. I said, I want you on board. And, you know, we'll try to set up something in the schedule and figure out what you're going to direct. And as a huge compliment to me, he held up the script we'd been discussing, the one I wrote. And he said, if you don't let me direct this one, I'm not interested.
Oh, wow.
And I said, done. And he did an amazing job. And since then, we had our paths had crossed on different projects that we were, you know, possibly getting done at the studios. We're actually a revival of some version of Sheena was in the talks for a while. I think there actually is one being done as well at the moment. And Carl was a part of that, at least as far as consultation. But I asked him one time, we were having lunch, and the fans would always come up, and most of them would deliver a line from one of his movies. And he would always laugh, and he would say something like, yeah, that's good. He goes, wow, or he'd give the line back or something like that. And it was really, really nice. And then when they would walk away, it wasn't like he was angry or upset or anything like that. And so I asked him about it as we were leaving the restaurant, and I told him how much I appreciated the way he treated the fans. And he said, oh, you know, they're fans of my work. They're good people. And he goes, I just, you know, they're coming up to say they appreciate something. I'm flattered. And then he kind of paused and he says, it's a bit of a problem in the bathrooms, but he goes, most of the time it's good.
I've heard about the bathroom thing.
Yeah. So, but he was just a, you know, that's such a huge loss. Talented and, you know, a personal loss, yes, but I mean for the community in general. And again, just an example of really the fact that stardom does not have to consume you.
No.
He's still just Carl.
I love that. I love that story. That's beautiful. Yeah, I love it. The person who made the biggest impact that was an actor on me was James Gardner. And you've heard the story, so I probably shouldn't say it again.
Tell it again, though. No, tell it again, because it's a good story.
I was working at Universal. And I, at that time, it was my first year. So I was just 16. I didn't have a car yet. And this is one of the reasons I was working there, was to earn money for a car. And where City Walk is was nothing. It was just land, and it was dirt roads. And one dirt road went down to the studio, and the other one went to the parking lot for the tour. And there was this rickety gate that was always open. And so one of the responsibilities for the people in the parking lot was one person would be assigned to watch the gate for a week. So I got assigned. And so you're in the middle of nowhere with no car, no walkie-talkie. They have an umbrella, a table, a chair. I brought my sunglasses, the little blue visors we wore. a book and a canister of water. And that's all I had there. Middle of nowhere. And I was a kid. And I looked younger than I was. So here I am 16, and I probably at that time looked about 12. And James Gardner, the way they, because Universal is so spread out and so huge, they use golf carts to get around. So James Gardner came up the hill, and he saw me, and he stopped his golf cart, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm guarding the gate," which made me laugh. Even when I said it then and when I say it now, I was a tiny little girl, and I'm guarding the gate. And he said, "They assigned you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you have a car?" "No." "Did they give you a walkie-talkie?" "No." "Get into this Jeep." And I was like, "But I'm supposed to," he said, "Young lady, get into this Jeep." And I go, "Okay." I mean, to me, at that time, he was Rockford and Maverick and a hero, and he'd been in movies with Doris Day. I mean, I would do what he told me to.
Yeah.
And so as we're driving to the toll booth where the managers and people were, we were just talking. He said he had daughters my age, and what school do you go to? What are you studying for? You know, normal stuff that an adult would ask a child. And he asked me how old I was. I told him. He goes, "Well, you look younger." And he goes, "I thought you were about my daughter's age." And we were just, you know, like that. And so he parked behind the toll booth, and he said, "You stay right here. I'm going to talk to your boss." And I looked at him with scared, a terrified face. And he said, "You're not in trouble. Just stay here." And but the thing was, the booths were like made of plexiglass. I could hear every word he was saying. And basically he was screaming at my poor boss, saying, "How can you leave that child in the middle of nowhere? Anything could have happened to her. I don't want to see not just her, but anybody up there without a car and a walkie-talkie and some kind of protection." I mean, he was just so angry. And I couldn't hear what my boss was saying. And then he said, came back, he said, "Don't look scared. Everything's fine. Just go back in there, and you're not going to get that duty anymore." And I said, "Okay, thank you, sir." He goes, "Jimmy." I go, "Thank you, Jimmy." But I was like, that one came out very hesitantly, because he was like, now he reached the part of God. So I said, "Thank you," and I shook his hand, and I went in, and I walked in like I was going into my death. Because I was sure he was going to kill me, my boss. And he said, "No," before, I didn't even say anything. And he said, "I'm not going, you're not in trouble, and I'm not mad at you. But I have to talk to my boss, because the way we delegate is just, you know, people, it's on a rota. But thanks to Jimmy, I got a promotion."
He's pretty incredible.
He was such a nice man.
He was one of the most recognized faces around the world back when he was at his peak. And, you know, people forget how, well, some people don't even know who he is, which you know, is not unexpected, but a bit of a shame, yeah. But, he goes back so far. He was, you know, every time you hear about Maverick, he was Maverick. He defined Maverick. He did so many. He did The Great Escape, a really big international movie. He goes back.
What was the movie he did with?
That's for sure.
What was the movie he did with Julie Andrews? That was such a good movie. It was the one where
Victoria, was it?
No. The one Victor before Victoria. That was one of them. But the one before that was the first movie Julie did after Mary Poppins, and he was a soldier. And she was She was working for like the, you know, for the British government, and it was during the war, and he was basically working for generals, and he was doing everything he could to stay out of war. And I can't remember the name of the damn movie.
To stay out of war?
To stay out of war. He was a coward.
Yeah.
And because he loved...
He's done so many.
Oh, but it was a really good movie. And it just... It really
after
stayed...
After Mary Poppins.
It was right after Mary Poppins, before Sound of Music.
Americanization of Emily?
That's it!
Oh, okay. Good. Boy, pop that one out of my head.
That's it. That's the movie. I can't believe I couldn't remember it. I've always loved that movie. Cause it was
I can't believe I actually thought of it.
Because it was such a different part for him. It was just a completely and utterly different character.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so brilliant in it. But he was so diverse. He played all different... He played... there was a movie called Sunset with Bruce Willis where he played... OK Corral, what are the brothers' names in the OK Corral?
There's Morgan. Of course, there's Wyatt. There's Morgan.
Wyatt. He played Wyatt. He played Wyatt Earp.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't young when he did that part, but
that was the hour of the gun.
No, this was called Sunset. It was old Wyatt. And he was supposed to be helping to be a consultant on a movie, and Bruce Willis played Tom Mix, and Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, later on. He did Wyatt Earp back in the 60s.
Yeah, I know. But this was a different Wyatt Earp. This was an old Wyatt Earp.
Okay, old man Earp.
Yeah, because one of the scenes that always stuck with me, and he did it so brilliantly, was when he was being a consultant and they did the gunfight. And they're showing the actors doing it, and they're showing the real one in his head and his face, a reaction to it. God, that was brilliant. He was such a genius.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. From a different time, but one of those totally personality actors. He brought his personality to every role, but he also played every role. It's kind of like Jimmy Stewart. Every Jimmy Stewart actor role was Jimmy Stewart, but he still, you know, portrayed the character. I mean, him playing Glenn Miller is still one of my favorites, but that's Jimmy Stewart. But we're getting off into ancient history.
I know, but I love the old movies. I'm an old movie buff. I'm a TCM fan.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you kids. I swear.
Huh. I'm not that much younger than you, Steve.
Yeah, well, revel in it while you have the youth.
But, I love old movies. But anyway, James Garner, and I met him several years later, like 10, and he remembered me.
Yeah. Well, see, I always get the question... when I go to talk to either school groups, especially not Hollywood, school groups out of the state, have you ever met anybody famous? And the thing is I don't think of things that way. You know, I have because I've worked with them. But they're people I've worked with. So, and I was at my high school a long time ago. And that question came up, have you ever met anybody famous? And I said, well, I don't know. You have to tell me who you think is famous. And somebody says, Johnny Depp. And I said, well, yeah, I've met Johnny Depp. And they were like, And I said, okay, well, let me tell you what my interaction with Johnny Depp was. I was working at Stephen J. Cannell Productions in the 80s. And Steve and Patrick Hasberg had just sold this new series called 21 Jump Street. And I'm walking down the hallway, and one of the producers is walking up the hall with this young kid. And we run into each other in the hallway, and he says, hey, this is Johnny Depp. He's one of the stars of Jump Street. And I said, welcome aboard, Johnny, and shook his hand. He said, thank you. There it is, my entire interaction with Johnny Depp. That was it. So technically, have I met somebody famous? No, because he was not famous at the time.
Oh, my God, that's so funny.
It sort of reminds me of something really funny that happened. I was working on Golden Girls, and I went to the bathroom, and I was a specialty player, and when you were a specialty player, you didn't have a dressing room. You had to go to the bathroom across the lawn to another side of the... Anyway, I walked to the bathroom, and in the middle, it was like a grassy area, and it's the old Selznick Studios where it was shot, and Tony Danza was playing Frisbee with the young man who was playing his son, and I just looked for a minute and went to the bathroom, and then I came back and went back, I was going back to the stage, and he accidentally hit me with the Frisbee, pretty hard. I mean, he has arms, that man. And he came running because it hit me in the shoulder and almost knocked me over because it was that hard. And he came running over. He said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, thank you. I'm fine, thank you." He goes, "Are you sure?" And I go, yeah, I'm fine. He goes, "All right, take it easy. Make sure your arm's okay. Move your arm up and down." And I did. He said, "Okay, good. All right, go to work." I go, "Yes, sir." And so I went to work, and that was it. That was the whole interaction. Very nice man. Mm-hmm. So that weekend, I was with my relatives because my grandma was sick, and she was in the hospital. And we were all sitting around the table, and I mentioned that I was working on Golden Girls, and I was just telling some stories. It was just to cheer up everybody because, you know, we all loved my grandma. And I mentioned this little tiny thing with Tony Danza that happened in seconds, and it was done, and I went back to work. One of my cousins, said, "Can I touch you where he touched you?" And I was like, "What?" She goes, "You, Tony Danza touched you. Where did he touch you?" Isn't that the weirdest reaction in the world?
I actually also had something similar to that at my high school. The same group of kids, and it was, you know, because another name that came up was Chuck Norris. And I had, of course, I'd written two episodes for Walker, Texas Ranger. One of them was produced. And the person, you know, asked me, had I ever met Chuck Norris? And I said, yeah, because I worked on the show for just, you know, a couple of episodes. And I said, I just, you know, met him at a party, and we just had a nice chat. And this guy kept staring at me, and I said, I did shake his hand. Would you like to touch my hand? And he did. He just reached out with a finger, and he's like, "Can I?" And I'm like, "Okay, whatever." So I'm sure he did it as a joke, but still, it was rather amusing.
I went, "Oh my God."
Yeah.
But
most people who live out here, though, you live in LA, you have encounters like that. And in other places, you know, Georgia is a hub for filmmaking now. You can do the same thing there. It just happens.
Mm-hmm. But it's just so strange. I had crushes. John Travolta kissed me on the cheek.
And you've not watched it since. We know. Yeah.
I mean, I said that when I was a kid. I was 13. Give me a break, Steve.
I had a friend who had just moved out here. She'd just come out here, and I knew her from Florida, from my high school and also college. And so she'd moved out, and again, one of my close friends, which I think you've actually, you've talked to Babs. Babs Grayhowski.
Lovely.
Yeah. So Babs and I were having dinner or lunch with her over at the California Pizza Kitchen in Studio City. And so we're sitting there, and she's facing us. And we're talking about, you know, what's it like now that you've moved out here? What do you think? And she said, you know, this thing about seeing celebrities all over the place. She goes, where are they? I have not seen a celebrity anywhere. And I just, do we have to go into Hollywood to see them? And I said, well, no, Hollywood's the last place, you know, down to Hollywood Boulevard is the last place. And she goes, well, I don't know where they are. And Babs and I kind of looked at each other, because sitting right behind her was Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Diane Keaton. And then over in the corner was Richard Dreyfuss. And we were like, okay.
Turn around.
I told her, I said, look, as casually as you can, look around. So she turned around and she saw Steve Martin and Martin Short and Diane Keaton. And she turns back very calmly and her face just opens up in this big wide, oh my God.
Yeah, that's like something that we're LA people are used to. I mean, Tony Roma's at Universal, when I was working up there, you saw actors all the time. It's not a big deal.
Well, I mean, it is kind of cool because you're like, oh my gosh, they're a lot different than I thought.
The way they look when they're not
taller, they're shorter. You always notice those.
Yeah.
That's true. It's not like, I remember when I was back in my hometown of St. Augustine, which is in Florida, and it's the oldest permanently inhabited European community in the United States. Thank you very much. I was working in the historical district, what they call the restored area, St. George Street, and it goes back to, you know, the city itself goes back to 1565. And so I was somebody dressed up as if it was in the colonial period of, like, the 1700s. And Bob Crane had been doing dinner theater, and he happened to be doing dinner theater in Jacksonville, and so he had come to St. Augustine, and he was right there on the street. And I was in one of the stores, and one of the other enactors there came in. She said, oh, my gosh, you know, Colonel Hogan is out there. He's here. He's in St. Augustine. And so I went out to look at him, as you do, because I was all of, like, 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
And he was eating an ice cream cone. And I remember I walked up to him, and I said, you're Bob Crane. And he was kind of like, you're interrupting my day kind of mode. And he just, uh-huh, that's me. And I went, oh, I said, you know, I love your show. And he goes, all right, thanks. And that was it. That was the interchange. Now, I had to put that in context. Yeah. The fact that this woman had come in and said, oh, Bob Crane is out there. Everybody was doing a looky-loo thing. So, but that was the first time. But everybody, I mean, our entire town was talking about that. That Bob Crane had actually come to the small town.
I'm sure he didn't think anybody would notice.
Well, I mean, and that's the other thing. The other side of it is, obviously, they know people are going to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And I will specifically ask friends of mine who are recognizable, if we go to lunch or we go to dinner, I will usually ask them, how do you want me to respond when somebody inevitably asks me if you're who you are? Because if I get up and go to the restroom, and this happened a few times, somebody will stop me along the way and say, hey, your friend looks an awful lot like, and then they'll name my friend. And so I say, do you want me to tell them, oh, wow, that's an interesting coincidence? Or, and pretty much all of my friends have just said, no, I'm used to it. Just tell them. Be honest with them. You know, going back to Carl, again, you know, when I asked him that question, we were going out to lunch, and I said, you know, if they come up and ask me, what do you want me to tell them? And he just turned to me and says, tell them you're my friend. I went, okay.
I love that.
He was such a cool guy. Yeah, he was such a cool guy. Anyway, so.
Well, he'll always be Apollo Creed to me.
Yeah.
But so. I loved him. I was sad, but you must be devastated.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock. But anyway.
To transition. Do you have anything coming up you want to let the audience know about?
Oh, well, as you know, every time we have our little chatting, which I enjoy quite a bit, by the way.
Thank you.
People out there should know, before we even start recording, we do spend about a half an hour just chatting. We just catch it up on things. We've known each other for such a long time. I have several things that are in the works, but many of the things are things I'd mentioned before because Hollywood works at this glacial pace. The graphic novel that Kevin J. Anderson and I wrote together, Stalag X, is still in the development mode with Francis Lawrence, set to direct it. Joy Wilkinson is writing the script. Kind of looking forward to that. I just actually got an email from his associate just a couple of days ago. I just finished up something that was a unique experience for me. We'll see where it leads. As some of you may know, if you know me or have followed me at all on any of my social media, I started out as an actor back in the 80s, and I became a writer and a producer, and I did all of that. Well, Renee O'Connor, who was one of the stars of Xena, she has founded her own theater company called the House of Bards. I advise you to look it up. And this theater company, it's a new one. It's actually kicking butt as far as the theater industry is concerned here in Los Angeles, because it's only been around a few years, and it just won a whole slew of awards with Broadway LA. I believe it was called Broadway LA when they do their yearly awards. But she was doing mainly Shakespeare. So this was several years ago, and she called me up and she said, "Would you mind being in one of our shows?" And I was like, "Oh, are you kidding? I have not done stage in, 40 years." And so she was doing Macbeth and wanted me to think about doing King Duncan. Fortunately, mercifully, King Duncan gets killed halfway through the play. And I agreed to it. Michael Ritchie was directing it. And Michael is somebody I actually knew from Florida State. He used to teach at Florida State. And he's an amazing director. I did a quick little tape for him. He was like, "Yes, let's do this." And so we had a great time doing this. And then she did Romeo and Juliet, and she asked me if I would consider being the friar. And so I did that. And then she did Midsummer Night's Dream and asked me if I would be Peter Quince, and I did that. So I was getting back on the stage, and I really do love it. Acting is, writing will always have the slight edge over my passion, but acting is right up there. So, little few pages go out the calendar because of, work and things like that. And then she calls me and says she is directing the musical of Matilda. And this is going to be done for the Encore Theater Group in the South Bay. And I've seen several of their productions. I really like them. They're a very interesting group. They also get families involved. They try to bring children into the arts. It's a wonderful group. And I had never done a musical, ever. Matilda is a musical. In fact, it's called Matilda the Musical, based on the Roald Dahl book. So one of the things I had always wanted to do when I was an actor in college was I wanted to do a musical, and I never had.
Oh, wow.
So she asked me if I would consider this, and she said, "I know you can act, and I know you can sing," only because she had seen me at the Xena conventions during the cabarets. I would occasionally sing. And I said no. At first I said no. And there were other aspects. I mean, I had to drive a good distance for the rehearsals and everything. But anyway, she followed up and talked me into it. And I agreed to doing it. So if you're ever familiar with the musical of Matilda, the role that I played was Trunchbull. And Trunchbull is the headmistress. So I had to be in drag. Now, I should make a differentiation. I had to play a female character.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, this role has been basically a cross-gender. Males or females can play it because the character of Trunchbull is very aggressive, very domineering, very much Y chromosome, all the stereotypical traits. And so it can go back and forth. And so she wanted me to play that role. So I agreed, and we had two casts, and I was Trunchbull in one of the casts, and the other one was a guy named Craig Benson, who's extremely talented, and also, certainly he built a lot of the sets that Encore uses. But I had to basically build up my look. Let's just be frank. I had to have boobs. So, and they had to be like Cadillac bumper bullets because you had to over-exaggerate everything. I also had sent Renee a photo of some boots that I had, which had 6-inch platforms. And she said, oh, that would be great. So then I had to perform in 6-inch platform boots, dancing, singing with boobs. I'm way outside of my bubble with this one. And I will tell you right now, buying the bra alone was an experience. I had, my wife was my consultant.
Of course.
And we're online looking at different bras, something I never thought that I would actually confess to. And the only thing I knew about bras when I was younger was how to undo the two snaps in the back. That was it. That's the extent of my knowledge back when I was a teenager. So now I am being deluged with all these specifications. First thing we had to do was figure out what size. That required measurement and then some sort of abstract thinking to decide what the cup should be. So we ended up with a 55 double D was going to be what I was going to use. So now we're looking at these different bras, and I realize it's not one bra, apparently. There's a bunch of different types. There's cross straps, there's single straps, there's sports bras, there's all of these things. And my wife is trying not to laugh at me as she's giving me advice.
And so Jessica's a brave woman.
Oh, it was hysterical. And so then we finally got to this one bra. I couldn't use a sports bra because that would basically compress things too much. And it was the opposite is what we wanted, exaggeration. So we finally decided on this one bra. And it snapped up in the back. And I went, wait a minute. That's a problem. Because even if I were to snap it in, you know, spin it around, snap it in the front, then spin back, that'll create a costuming problem. And, you know, of course, she says, well, you can get them to snap up in the front. And I went, oh, fantastic. So we found this one that snapped up in the front. And then we ordered it. And we got it in. And yes, it snaps up in the front with like 300 snaps, this incredible number of snaps. And no woman has been able to explain this to me, and certainly no bra manufacturer would dare try to explain this. But why is it when you snap the first one and you go to the first one unsnaps? And then if you go to the third one, the second one unsnaps, even if you resnap the first one. Who came up with this design?
That women have suffered for a long, long time.
Yes. Well, then let's take it another step further, where I actually had to design and manufacture the actual boobie proper. So I won't give you the long story on that, but that was a lot of shop rags stuffed into cut pantyhose, wrapped around and then separated with a small towelette so that they would not merge together into one gigantic boobie. Now, having done all of that with my costume and the wig, and I had to do makeup for myself, which, by the way, I really enjoyed. Back when I was doing theater, I really enjoyed doing makeup. I had to go out and buy a new makeup kit. I ended up wearing those shoes for every rehearsal, even when it was the other cast that was rehearsing, so that I could get totally comfortable wearing those shoes. And because it was 6-inch platforms, I dominated over the actress who was playing Matilda, a little girl named Evie, who was just incredibly talented. Both casts were amazing. Brooklyn was the name of the girl who was playing in the other cast, and she was amazing as well. But I was huge. And I realized that the first time I had everything all put together and we were doing a rehearsal, there's a moment where she steps forward and I step forward to her, and it's kind of like a face-off. And I realize I can't see her because of the boobies. So we did this rehearsal. We actually mounted it a couple of weekends ago. I will tell you, it was a fantastic experience. I danced. I sang with, there were 90 plus cast members. I think 60 of them were kids, and they were great. I had to throw a ragdoll child off the stage, like a hammer throw, spinning around in those shoes, and somebody actually took a video of me backstage dancing to one of the numbers, and that got posted on the media. So, kind of a long discussion about that, but that was kind of a cool experience. And I've often said that my life consists of checking things off a bucket list that I didn't know I had. That was one that was on the bucket list. So I managed to do that as a musical. So as far as, I've still got my projects. I'm still developing certain things. I have a project called Eventide that I'm developing with Diana Zimmerman, another project called Madam B that we're trying to push forward, also working with collaborators. There is a little bit of the acting bug that has popped back in here, and the question is whether I want to actually pursue it or just kind of step back and hope another role comes to me. But doing it was cool. And I have to tell you, working with Renee is just exceptional. She is just one of the most talented, creative people I've ever met.
That is so fun. Oh, my God. I wish I could have seen it. I wish I could have come.
It was a full house almost every night.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it at all. But I actually would have loved to have seen that. Renee won a bunch of awards. I didn't know that.
Her company, House of Bards, yeah, it did really, really well. There's a is it called Broadway LA? I think it's called Broadway LA.
Was it regional theater?
It right,
was that what it was for? Regional theater?
It's for hold on a second. Let me see if I can bring it up here, and I can tell you what it was. Broadway World, Los Angeles. That's what it is. It's called Broadway World Los Angeles, and it's the 2023 Broadway World Los Angeles Awards.
Huh.
And, and I think her House of Bards company won in various levels. I think she won about 7 or 8 awards, because she wasn't just doing Shakespeare. She also did the play 1984.
Wow.
Based on the book.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, that was the first full-length play I had ever done when I was in high school. And I played Winston Smith in that one, but I was doing other things, so I could not have even been a part of that. But quite honestly, good thing, because the people who were in it were amazing. And it's a scary play. And Renee told me, she said, "I'm going to take it in that direction." She goes, "I'm going to be pretty, blatant and upfront with this." And it was so well done.
Well, 1984 is a scary book, so that makes sense.
Yes, it is. It is a cautionary tale that more people should read.
Yeah.
She went for it, because it's not for the squeamish. There are torture scenes that are in it, and Renee said her intent was she wanted the audience to be uncomfortable with this. And I can tell you, she succeeded. It worked.
She takes chances. She always has. She's amazing.
She does. Yeah, she's not afraid to put it out there. She wants people to think, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I remember when she did her plays that she wrote, little one-act, and with, scenes from different facts of life for a woman. It was really good, but it was really, really out there. She really pushed the buttons, It was brilliant. I hope she's still writing,
I'm not sure what you're referring to when you say that. She's not really, she wouldn't tell you she was a writer.
No, but she wrote that play.
Which play are you referring to?
The one she did at the Xena convention, where she played these women and different women characters.
Oh, those things. Yeah, I know what you're referring to, because I have a lot of photos with that one. That's interesting. I'm going to bring that up to her. I wasn't sure how much of that she had written or not. It's a very effective. Yeah, it was a group of sketches.
Yeah.
Dealing with different issues.
that's what I meant. Sorry, my brain isn't that good. But yes, that was really amazing play. So I just wondered if she's still writing.
Not to my knowledge. But then again, it's not something that has actually come up in our conversation. But she certainly has taken the theatrical experience very, very seriously. And she is just a wonderful director. Obviously, and she's producing, because she has her own theater company. And she did, some independent films as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
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 talented woman.
One of the things that certainly came out of Xena, I mean, Xena, we just had another Xena convention a couple of weekends ago, or I should say a Xenite reunion. Technically, that's what that was. And it is amazing how many people are new to these conventions and new to Xena. You know, a whole bunch of people out there in the audience who weren't even born when this series was first on the air. And everybody who got up there, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of the actors and people behind the scenes got up there. And the first thing we'd ask is, how many people have never come to one of these conventions? And for me, 40% of the people raised their hands.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, welcome aboard. You're now a member of the tribe. It is an incredible fandom.
It is.
It really is. And that show changed, you know, it certainly changed my life. I was, you know, I had a very successful career up until that point. So Xena wasn't the thing that made my career, but it did make so much of what my life is now. And I mean that not just in a professional sense. I mean that in the people that I know, the friends I have made, the people who have stayed with me. And even today, that show is a part of our pop culture, and it still has relevance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Xena was really an amazing show because there wasn't a show that I had seen that had done what Xena did. First of all, the two women as leads, but also they did everything. They did comedy, they did farce, they did slapstick, they did a murder mystery, they did musicals, they did... You never knew week to week what you were going to get. I mean, that's one of the fun parts of Xena. No other show has done it since, and I don't think anybody did it before.
We did break a few boundaries, especially in the genre circuit, because, yeah, it was true. When we got especially to the third season and beyond, one week could be a slapstick comedy, then the next week you're dealing with infanticide. So we managed to be able to run that gamut back and forth because of the characters, the depth of the characters, the actors who were playing the characters, the writers who were putting together these stories. I've always said it was lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
We just managed to capture that. And it resonated. As I think I said at the con, for a lot of the Xena fans out there, every show becomes its own life.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. And it has its own heartbeat. But many shows, the heartbeat is out of sync, either within the cast. The cast might be out of sync with the production crew or something like that. There's always something that's a little out of sync. Most shows are like that, and they cover it very well. Even though we were a dysfunctional family, I'll be the first one to say that, we all resonated with the same basic heartbeat. And then what happened is you can only hope and pray that your audience that has that same resonance will find you. And that's what happened with Xena.
It did, yeah.
Our fandom found us. We resonated in them with the messages, with the entertainment, with the fun, with the tragedy, with everything we were doing. And as a tribute to the show itself, we are talking about a show that went off the air 23 years ago. And it is still, that heartbeat is still resonating with so many people. And so many of those people have become friends of mine. Not just fans of the show I did, but actual people that I can just sit down and have a chat with. And it's just an amazing thing. It changes your life.
Yep. Hey, I'm one of them. I'm one of the people. I was at the convention. I didn't know who you were. I just thought you were a photographer when I said hi to you. Because, I mean, you walked around. I mean, and then I saw you on stage. And he's Stephen Sears. Oh my God. I shouldn't have done that.
Well, for those who don't know, photography is one of my hobbies. So I always, you know, would do that. And also, you know, I certainly don't consider myself that big a deal, so I don't stay backstage. I wander out and I talk to people. You know, everybody's respectful. It's great. And yes, you're not the first person to tell me they did not know who I was because I happened to be having a conversation with them, and then they do the announcement, and, you know, coming up on stage now, Stephen Sears. And I was like, I'll be with you in a moment. I'd go run up on stage. And we're like, oh my God, that's who I was talking to. So they just kind of realize I'm just Steve. That's all I am.
But let me, this might embarrass you. You really were one of the people who helped me with things that I needed help with, like when I decided to do the show, when I decided to do Sherry's Playhouse, I asked you, what do you think? Do you think it's crazy? Do you think I should try? And you always said, sure, go for it.
Yeah, should. Look what's happened. I mean, it's crazy is what pushes us forward. We're all crazy. I'm crazy. That some of us allow ourselves to be openly crazy. We take the risks. You know, when I've talked about creativity, as we talked before the show started, you know, I do lectures and appearances for a broad base of groups, and I will talk about creativity. I'll talk about the psychology behind it, and because I had to look back on my life and say, you know, where do my friends get this? Where did I get this? And one of the things that I talk about is that we build these little walls around ourselves from childhood. And a lot of that comes from our environment. I point out, I say, you know, when a child comes from the universe, they basically came from everywhere. Oh my gosh, they should know everything, but they don't speak our language, so we have to teach them a language. And the moment you're doing that, you are kind of putting a box around them because you're teaching them a method of expressing themselves, but that's fine. But then one of the words they hear most often is the word no. And it's meant to be protective. No, don't touch that. It'll hurt you. No, stay away from that. It's dangerous. But after a while, that no starts to expand. No, don't do that. It's embarrassing. No, don't wear that. That's shameful. And we start building these little walls around ourselves, and we don't realize it until the little child is completely trapped in walls. And what creativity really is kicking down those walls and saying, I want to be a child again. I want to be that mind that explores and thinks of all the possibilities and looks at all the perspectives. But it's really difficult to knock down those walls. So when anybody says to me, I can't do something, I kind of translate that as I'm saying, in the creative film, if you're saying that you have a really difficult wall to kick down, it doesn't mean that you aren't capable of doing it. It doesn't mean you're not creative. It just means that you're scared because the walls are comforting. And with you, you kick down the walls, you know? Even when you said, it's like, if you had said to me, if the word actually was, is this ridiculous? My response was probably something like, yes, that's why you should. You know?
I don't think I actually said it, but I thought
it was something, it was to that effect.
Yeah.
I was leaving the house a couple of days ago, and there were these two young women, teenagers, and they were out on the street, and they were obviously doing a little video, maybe a TikTok, maybe not. And so I was heading out to my car, and I saw them over there, and they saw me, and there was a little bit of embarrassment, because there they are doing this in the middle of the street. And they looked at me, and one of them said, you know, we're doing a little video here. And I said, okay, that's fine. And as I walked over to my car, she said, yeah, I know it's ridiculous. She actually said the word ridiculous. And I said to her, I said, you know what? In my world, there is no such thing as ridiculous, so keep going. And I believe that.
Yeah. Well, if you don't, you need the encouragement. But if you don't try, you'll never get anything.
That's the thing. It's like I say about writing when people want to write. I always say, I'm no writer. And I go, wait a minute, hold on. Gosh, that sounds so familiar. Where did I hear that? Oh, I remember. It's what I used to tell myself. And the key to writing is I tell them, what you are thinking is that you're going to fail at becoming a award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning, Nobel laureate poet or writer. You're going to fail at that. That's what you're thinking because that's the wall that's up there. But writing, as a good example, is such an internal, personal thing. You could write and just not show it to anybody else, and you actually feel wonderful about doing that. Or you start to show it to people, and you have to have thick skin.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to take the input, but also understand that it's not an attack on you. It's all to build your creativity. There's a whole attitude about it, a whole philosophy. But it extends to almost every creative area. And I just tell people, try it. Just go there. See how you feel about it, because at the very least, you'll get some satisfaction that you did it. And then I will say, and for the people who are friends of those people, and especially the family of those people, allow them to do that. Teach them responsibility. Make sure they know how to pay their bills. That's for sure. Everybody in this business knows that one. But allow them, you know, support them. Anyway, that's kind of my soapbox speech about that. But I really think most people have a creativity that they're afraid to tap.
Yeah. That was my parents.
And I'm selfish. I want to see it.
My parents were like that. They were very, they were like, at one hand, they wanted me to be creative. They wanted me to do what I wanted to do. I mean, they put me in dancing classes and stuff, so they knew that it would have an effect. But at the same time, like you said, they always taught me responsibility. They taught me, you have to, there's going to come a time we're not going to be here. You're going to have to take care of yourself. So you have to know how to earn a living. You know, stuff like that.
That's one thing that creatives have to learn how to do, is you've got to be responsible with your life. But that doesn't mean you have to give up on your creativity or your passions. It just means they have to work hand in hand. And it can be done, obviously. People do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you just got to try. Is it going to kill you if you don't get an audition or your writing gets rejected? No. It may hurt your feelings. You may get a little depressed for a day or two. Then you get over it, and you go back, and you try again. That's what it is.
And after, yeah. And after a while, you get used to that because that's a part of the business. I was dating this one woman who was an attorney. She was not really in the creative side of the business. And she one time asked me this question. You know, she said, "What do you do if you're unemployed? How do you deal with that?" And I said to her, I said, "That's interesting that you phrase it that way, because in my creative film, the way we phrase that is, what do you do when you're unemployed? Not if, when. Because most of it is that. It is contract labor at best. It's sporadic. You have to have a passion for it. You have to have an ability to, a willingness to get out there and work for it. So you just kind of get used to it. And aside from acting, I have pitched and developed many, many series which never ended up on television. But most of this business never ends up on a screen. Most of the business never ends up on your streaming services. Most of it is development, is trying to get something to move forward. So I have had, I cannot tell you, it's countless in my mind, how many times I have pitched in studios and networks series ideas, and nothing has happened about it. Sometimes they have hired me to develop, and then they cut it off later on. Most of my career, most of the money I've made has come off of those things, as with most people in the business. But what I love is the ability to actually get in and pitch, because I consider that to be the victory. If they're going to say no, fine, they're going to say no, but I'm there. I get to tell them this cool, awesome story, these great characters I came up with. I get my opportunity to do that, and I'm happy with that. Now, is it disappointing when they say no? It can be. I've kind of gotten to the point that it's not. I'm used to it, and I also, again, I don't look at it as a personal attack on me. There's 100 reasons why they could say no. There can only be one reason why they say yes, and when they say yes, you really don't care about the other reasons.
Yeah, you're just going, yay!
Yeah, so for actors, yeah, it's constant rejection, but that is the business, and you do, and not to diminish it, you do have to find a way to balance that feeling out in yourself.
Yeah.
And I have also said, the moment this business becomes miserable, I mean totally miserable, not just the ups and downs, get out of it. There are easier ways to make money.
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, when I was doing TV work, it was periodic. I was working in department stores. I had just started learning how to do travel. I mean, I was doing other stuff. I was working for work. I was, you know, but I always made sure that my boss knew I'm going on an audition. I could get it, and they would always say, "Cool, go ahead." I mean, I had good bosses that were really cool, too. There's a balance. And that's, but you have to work. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be a star. I'm going to do, No. You have to know that you have to work, you know, even if it's part-time, doing whatever you want to do. But I never waited tables, okay? But I always worked.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, waiting tables, the reason that's a cliche is because it did allow most actors flexibility to go off on their auditions. But it, you know, it is absolute, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who gets into this should understand that first and foremost. So you have to work for it. Again, what's it worth it to you?
Mm-hmm.
You have to make that decision. And, you know, I have another friend who came out here to be an actor, and he was actually very good, acting-wise, as far as film and television. He was in more things than I was. He didn't like the business. He just didn't like the process of it. And so he went back to another trade that he had learned and became very, very successful in that, working in the studios but behind the camera. Totally happy. Completely happy. He found his place. But to his credit, he was not obsessed with this idea of stardom.
Mm-mm.
He wasn't there to win awards. He was there to do the one thing that everybody wants to do, the one goal that everybody has.
Make a living being a creative.
No.
No?
Well, that may be it, but I'll tell you what that one goal is. And it is absolutely true. The one goal you have is to be happy.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That is the thing. Now, if it means that, you know, if it means that, you know, becoming a working actor is the thing that makes you happy, great, you should go and do that. As I've often said, the thing that you want to be is your goal is to be happy. What makes you miserable is trying to figure out how to do that. And that's why I say, if it becomes miserable, get away from it, because you're forgetting, you're losing sight of your goal.
Mm-hmm.
One of my little things that I say, and this is, this gets a laugh with a lot of people, but it is absolutely not a joke. When I have listed my credits, when people have asked me what I've done, and my credits go back and forth, you know, acting, writing, producing, you know, even the photography, you know, back and forth and all these things. I've done a lot of things. But I will end it by saying, eventually I'll figure out what I want to do when I grow up.
Now,
and it's not really a joke.
I know, because I'm laughing because I've said that too.
Yeah. And because what I'm actually saying is that most people define growing up as, well, get serious and forget about all that idealism, all that stuff that you want to do, all the passion that you have. Come on, get a job, have a family, have kids. And that's absolutely fantastic if you want to do that. But it's not one or the other. It doesn't have to be one or the other. So I'm just basically saying, I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up because I'm just having too much fun being what I am.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So, hard to define.
I understand. We're at the end, and I'm sure you're happy because we've been talking for an hour and a half.
Oh, no, we're not at the end. I've got some good years left in me. We are not at the end yet.
Oh.
No, I've got a few more things I want to do.
I mean the show.
Oh, that.
The show. Yes. I just wanted you to do the usual because, you know, there's people who might not know you. Could you give your website and any kind of social media you're on?
Well, I would also say that if you have stuck with us for the last hour and a half,
you know
you
who he
know
is.
You certainly know more about me now than you intended. Well, I'll tell you, I am on social media. My website is StephenLSears.com. That's StevenLSears.com. And the L is important. Stephen L. Sears is my actual professional name. If you look up StephenSears.com, you won't find my website. You will find a website on how to clean your ears. Stephen's.
Really?
I swear, that is actually true. And it may be totally 100% helpful, but it is not me.
No.
So on that, you will find links to what was formerly Twitter, my Facebook page. Generally, on most of the social media, my listing at address is FSU Writer, FSU meaning Florida State University Writer. That's true on Instagram. I believe that's also true on X. So you'll be able to find me that way. But yeah, the initial website, StephenElsevier.com. That has the portals. Also, I will be doing more updates. It has been lax for a while. Anybody who knows will go and look at it will notice, that beard is a lot darker than I've seen in his current photos. So I'll be updating that pretty soon. But anyway, that's where you can find me if you want to keep up with stuff or, you know, just kind of stare at pictures. I don't know.
He has a lot of pictures, though, too. Thank you, Steve, for taking the time to be on my show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Instacart and get your family's sick day essentials delivered in as fast as 30 minutes. Press 2 to keep working. Do not press 2. Just use Instacart, Brian.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.